So, also, there are apparently people listening who use MATLAB. I was wondering what people thought of an open source product called GNU Octave, which is supposed to be very similar to MATLAB. Easy to IM.
Yeah, Christopher, my son, is a big GNU fan. Maybe he knows about that. And I think the HP50G is a discontinued model. So probably the Prime is the thing that took over from it. But I've got a Terra 48 and a 50, and it does everything I need, so I don't need updating right now. Let's see, anybody have any further questions or comments on all of the above before we go over to the space report? K2RI, I'll be listening.
Santo Jean, did you see the picture?
Yeah, I forgot to mention that, Wes. I did see the picture, and it does have a different layout than the usual directional coupler. So I'm now doubtful it's a directional coupler. I think it's more likely a Wilkinson hybrid. It's a power summer, power divider, if you know what I mean. By way of your ohmmeter test and your signal generator test or your vector network analyzer test, you're soon going to find out what it is. But for $2, you've got a bargain. Guarantee that device brand new is $3,000. Over to you, Wes.
No, I'm willing to bet if you put it on a BNA, you're going to find one 90 degrees away from the other.
If it's a Wilkinson hybrid, they're going to be 0 degrees away from each other, Eric.
Yeah, that's true. But I'm thinking about something that I worked on many years ago. Which, one input was 90 degrees off from the other one.
Yeah, that's a so-called quadrature hybrid, which is a sense, which is also an extremely valuable thing. A quadrature hybrid is a very sophisticated way. Let me drop this. A very sophisticated way of joining together two transmitters. The magic of a quadrature hybrid used as a power summer and power divider is that each individual transmitter can have an extremely high output standing wave ratio. Each individual amplifier can have an extremely high input standing wave ratio. And if you're using a quadrature hybrid at the input and a quadrature hybrid at the output to join those two transmitters, you will see a perfect 50 ohm load at the input, you'll see a perfect 50 ohm source at the output, and the two transmitters will be thoroughly isolated from each other. Beautiful. That's called the Kurokawa technique. Mr. Kurokawa invented the technique of using a pair of quadrature hybrids as a way of combining the inputs and outputs of two amplifying devices, two transmitters, for instance. So, if it's a quadrature hybrid, and it could be, another very valuable thing. So, good luck with those tests. You'll eventually find out what it is. Since one of your pictures is at the bottom, and I see there's about 6 screws where you could remove the bottom cover, if you remove the bottom cover, if you chose to, and then send us a picture, Eric and I would be able to tell you exactly what it is even before you run any RF test. By way of what we see with the bottom cover off, we would tell you, is it a quadrature hybrid? Is it a Wilkinson hybrid? What is its frequency range? What is its power rating and so on? We could give you 90% of those answers by looking at a picture of the inside when you remove that bottom cover. N2XJN, K2RIW, go ahead, Wes.
Quadrature hybrid, you have 3 inputs, but my understanding is that you should have 2 outputs. No, actually, you should have 1 output. What then the load is for? My understanding is the load is 6,050 ohm. Am I right?
Think of it as reject. It could be the reject termination, or the word load could really mean the summed output. So, 2 inputs become 1 output by way of either a loop.
The fact that it says antenna says that load is really a reject load.
Probably so. But if we see a picture of with the bottom cover off, we'll know exactly what it is. So the next step, giving us a picture with the bottom cover off, will narrow down the mystery as to what your $2 beautiful purchase really is. Over to you, Wes.
Yeah, you got me left with reject. Tell me more.
Eric, you got an answer to what I think is a question? You gave us some words, Wes. We think you're asking a question. We don't know what the question is.
I can hear. I've lost the microphone for a second. We put amplifiers together or transmitters together. If they are not perfectly in phase, you're going to generate an output, which is going to come out of that thing that goes into the load. For example, if you lose one transmitter, you're going to lose 6 dB of your output. And that energy has to go somewhere, and that's going to wind up in your load terminal, which will go to a load of whatever value, half the power of whatever your system is.
Over to you, Wes.
I think I understand what you're saying. So in other words, I'm losing one transmitter now. The power goes to the load. Then are we going to have half of the power as the antenna? Or are we going to have nothing? That power is dissipated by the load. Eric.
The way most hybrids work is that if everything is matched in amplitude and phase, the power gets summed to the whatever is the output. The so-called graceful degradation, let me drop this. The worst case is if you completely lose one of the transmitters. The two transmitters still stay completely isolated. Everything stays impedance matched. But of the power left that you're still generating, half of it will go to the output, half of it will go to the load. So in the worst case, if one transmitter goes completely down, you're 6 dB down in resultant power output, but you're still on the air. They call that graceful degradation. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW.
So in other words, you're saying is that you never have double power. You have always the power of one transmitter. Is that what I should understand from that? And to HCN?
You made a logical guess. The answer is no. If the two transmitters are perfectly matched in amplitude and phase, and if each one is running 100 watts, you do get 200 watts of output. If one of the transmitters is supposed to be 100 watts and it goes down to 50, and now you've got a 50 plus 100 being combined, you're going to get something like 125 out. If one of the hundreds completely fails, so you get 100 plus 0, you'll get 50. So in the worst case, as the difference between the two gets higher and higher, a bigger percentage goes to the load terminal, but never more than 50%. But if the two transmitters are perfectly matched, 0% goes to the load, all of it goes to the output. Over to you, Wes, K2RIW. That's the way hybrids work.
What makes the phase magic? Is it load? Does the load participate in phase matching? Enter it here.
The magic of a hybrid, Quadrature hybrid or Wilkinson hybrid and a few other hybrids, is that they allow you to losslessly combine the outputs of two transmitters. They allow you to keep the two transmitters isolated from each other, so one does not create oscillation with the reactant of the other. That's the good news. But when you're combining powers with a hybrid, half of the difference goes into the load. If the two are matched, there's no difference, nothing goes into the load, everything goes to the output. Half of the difference ends up in the load. That's a slight disadvantage, but that's the price you pay to completely isolate and have graceful degradation. You don't have to worry about if the transmitter becomes dead and becomes a dead short circuit, doesn't matter. Half the power of the remaining transmitter still goes output. You're still on the air, but you're 6 dB down. That's why they call it graceful degradation.
Be a real world example.
In order for everything to be amplitude matched and phase matched, you, the designer of the system, I'm going to make sure that your two transmitters have a throughput characteristic that has a known gain, a known amplitude, and a known phase shift. You are going to make the phase shift. If your two transmitters are perfectly matched in amplitude, but to each 180 degrees out of phase, in that particular case, all your power will go to the load and none will go to the output. That's the worst case. KE2EJ, K2IW, go ahead, Eric.
Draw this picture in your mind, Wesley. This is a real quick example. I have a transmitter, a single transmitter, that consists of 12 amplifiers. Each pair of amplifiers goes into a Wilkinson divider, combiner rather. And each one of those outputs goes into another set of Wilkinson combiners. So any one of those boards could fail, and because they're isolated from one another, the transmitter keeps going with what's left. That's the whole concept of being able to have something fail and continue onward until you fix your problem.
Now I understood perfectly. Thank you very much for that explanation. Dick.
Yeah, you oversimplified a little bit there, Eric. In order to take 12 transmitters, the first step of combining gives you 6 hybrids. That in turn gives you 3 hybrids. That in turn gives you either a 3-to-1 combiner. So you've got 3 stages of hybrids.
We split it into 6 and 6, so it becomes 2 in the end.
Beautiful, beautiful. Okay, so you've got a 6-way power divider. That's no longer a simple Wilkinson. But is it a Wilkinson-like 6-way power divider? Is the first step, Eric, go ahead.
Well, you know, there's 2 different schools of thought. I've worked on some really awful transmitters that have the 6 and 12-way dividers, which are really more like a star, and they're not really hybrids, which is kind of really crappy. And that, in turn, goes into a real set of hybrids to combine banks together. But most of the good stuff, if you have multiple voids in your transmitters, even back in the tube days, they'll take 2 outputs, put that into a 1 Wilkinson network, and pair them off, so that way you'd actually have 3 outputs. That would in turn go into another bank of 2 input devices, and then that would then in turn, you know, go into another bank of 2 input devices to lead to the final output. They tend to do that so that they don't get any of these secondary failures that can happen.
And if you took that 6-to-1 power divider and opened it up, it may be a combination of a whole bunch of 2-to-1s plus a 3-to-1 inside of that one package of that 6-to-1. And if they did do it that way, the slightly more elaborate way, it would give you all of the isolation that you want and yet all of the potential efficiency you would like. Over to you, Eric.
No, again, they tend to manufacture, you know, 4 terminal devices, or, you know, 4-port devices, 2-port devices, however you want to describe it, and then, you know, multiplex them together in a tree kind of organization. I have yet to see a single divider that has, say, 4 inputs and 1 output. It can be done, they just don't do it.
4 inputs and 1 output could be a double set of 2+1 hybrids. A total of 3 hybrids could give that to you, Eric.
I'm aware, but they tend not to put it all in one package. They tend to make a package that they use universally throughout the transmitter, except for the final combining, because of the you know, each step of the way, the power gets higher, so the physical device has to be able to handle more of kind.
Does your individual transmitter run close to the kilowatt level?
Well, the log cam that we got in the city, which is like 1970 technology, beautiful transmitter, never fail. Each board can produce about 1,500 watts.
1,500 watts per board, and how many of those boards are being combined?
Okay, in the analog days, that transmitter will get you 30 kilowatts when you add them all up together. You can divide it out. I can't remember precisely how many boards it is. Because I haven't seen it in a while. What I have here is an 800 watts a piece, and they are a total of 12 of them. And then another smaller transmitter that I have, they produce 300 watts a piece, and I think there's 16 of them, which is really awful.
But do you believe they've got rather high reliability with either of those approaches, Eric?
you're talking about 40,000-50,000 hours between failures. Although, I got to admit that the French-speaking transmitter that I have, it's all written in Le Francais, that uses 480-volt switching supply, three-phase. They have two microprocessors in each power supply, and they're water-cooled, and they're a genuine pain in the rear end, and they do have a tendency to break because the PSC&G is not the cleanest source of energy in the world.
I think you're saying that the system cannot tolerate very big glitches without either tripping out or developing a failure. Is it a trip-out problem, or does it really develop a failure that requires a replacement of components?
Well, okay, one thing I will say about these switching supplies, they're producing 50 volts at, I think 150 amps, something like that. When there's a 2 or 3 millisecond switch in the line, and I've measured this, it actually causes a loss of output for, you know, X number of milliseconds. That's how sensitive these switching supplies are. They're running around 56 kilohertz. So the filter caps in the ends are not very big, and they're not really a storage device, per se. So when it gets whacked, the switching surfaces also get whacked. And if one of the phases tends to drop out or has a hole in it, one of those transistors gets very unhappy. Has a lot of current running through it, and that's where the failure begins from.
So I think you're saying that switching power supply, for a period of time, it sees half the normal input voltage. It goes into a failure mode?
Yeah, well, the sophistication of these devices, including the old transmitters, they have three-phase monitors. And the minute one phase is either, I think it's 15 or 20 degrees out of position, it'll actually shut it off. One of them's missing, it'll shut it off. If the voltage drops by, I think, 15% on any input, it'll shut it off. And sometimes it just doesn't shut it off fast enough while a switching transistor is in the middle of being hit the ground with all that energy. The signal will come back and say, you know, open up. Doesn't happen, the transistor tends to fry.
Is that a difficult repair that you're able to handle, or is that a sub-assembly that gets mailed back to the factory?
Well, the way broadcast transmitters are, and the way the lack of people capable of dealing with that stuff is becoming fewer and fewer, the standard procedure for most places, which you can't sell, like, is to call up the manufacturer, they'll overnight you another one, and you send them back the bad one. If you're really gutsy, like I am, I tend to fix a lot of stuff, but some things I won't fix because I don't have the tools. I mean, they have to be high-priced. You need nice, heavy three-phase lines to go into those power supplies in the first place. And it's nasty stuff. It's like, yeah, I can fix it, but I ain't gonna.
If there's a particular vulnerable sub-assembly, would it be worthwhile to have one of those sitting on the shelf ready to be substituted the next time you get a failure?
Yes, but there's a negative side of it. And that is, I can get a replacement supply for, I think, what is it, $1,800 or $2,000, and I got six of them. Or I can get the individual boards, which cost maybe $1,000 a piece, because that's just the way it is. I mean, you know, they sell you a 20-cent capacitor for $10 or $15. Actually, the load resistors that I use, I mean, I can buy them from Al or Abnet for $12 or $14, and I buy it from the manufacturer, it's like $50, so, you know, take your choice.
It sounds like the whole down power supply is only 50% more costly than the particular board that's inside that fails. Therefore, you've got a spare power supply sitting on the shelf, is what I think you're saying.
No, that's the beauty of why I don't, is that just by dual system divider, if one board fails, it keeps going. One power supply fails, I only lost two boards. So I can wait overnight for them to send me another one.
And during that overnight, you're down to 60% of normal power output?
You know, it depends upon how much fail. But, you know, if I lose two boards, I lose maybe, what is it? Not transmitter, I think I lose about 800 watts, something like that.
What's the lowest percentage of power output you can go to where during the transition you must inform the FCC that you're in a partial power output mode on your broadcast transmitter? Over to you, Eric.
No, interestingly enough, the FCC still does have some rules. Actually, they've gotten rid of a lot of them. Just, they don't even know how to deal with digital stuff. Well, they're still becoming of age with that. But as a general rule, all broadcasters, you're allowed, and we do it in percentage of power. Whatever your license power is, that becomes 100%. So you have a little 20% window. You can go as low as 80% if you raise it out for power and not have to bother the FCC. Go below that, you've got 48 hours to notify them, and then when you fix it, you have to notify them.
So you're allowed to go down to 80% without notifying them. If you lose one board, can you still crank out 80%?
No, this transmitter, which is 5 kilowatts, and by the way, I only get 4 watts deflected out of 5 kilowatts, which is full. I go down to about, what is it, 94, 95. If I lose one board, if I lose two boards, I'm down in the 82 or 83.
Did you say 5 watts reflected out of 5,000?
I said 4 watts reflected.
Okay, 4 watts reflected out of 5,000. I'm working out the mathematics of that right now. That's an extremely low standing wave ratio.
It turned out to be about 1 to 1.06 something, something, something.
Sound good, Dick?
What was that again, Joe?
Mine's 31.
14.75?
No, no. I just said mine's 31. I'm doing it in my head, but it sounds like it is.
Minus 30.969. You rounded it off to minus 31. It's close. Very good, Joe. I think it's time to go over to the space report. WS2N is about to give a space report number 254 of the series. K2IW, go ahead, Paul.
Okay, this is WS2N for the space report part of the TechNet. The flight we talked about earlier in the net from Mars Island has been scrubbed for, well, 24 hours. They'll give it another try tomorrow. And they can go all the way up to the 18th. Tomorrow night, they'll try it again. And that's the one where they're going to launch a suborbital flight on a carrier rocket. It stands about, I guess, about, what, 30 feet long and maybe 2.5 feet, I guess, diameter. So, on you know, for the payload, they've got this canister that they're going to release after about 4 minutes after launch. The apogee in the ionosphere, and three different colors, some kind of chemicals for red, blue, and green. And I went out at, you know, right at the 9 o'clock was like a 9:07 launch. And I went out to look, but I didn't know it was canceled. So naturally, I didn't see anything. But we'll try again tomorrow night. It gets high enough in the atmosphere, and at 9 o'clock at night, or you know. That's roughly 9:15. It's still daylight up there, so that's why the sun will be reflecting these colors back. They said from New York down to the Carolinas. Well, we'll see. I don't have a very low angle that I could look at, maybe 10, 15 degrees. So if it's any lower than that, I'm out. I'd have to go down by the water. Another flight that's going to be going up is this Saturday, June 17th. Falcon 9 is going to be launched from Launch Complex 39A down in Florida. And that's the same complex that most of the Apollo missions launch from and most of the shuttle launch vehicles launch from now. SpaceX has taken that over. And they've done a number of flights from there already. And this is a Bulgaria satellite that they're launching for Bulgaria, for a company in Bulgaria, for a communication satellite that we launched and put over Europe around 2 degrees west on a geosynchronous orbit. Interesting about the booster is it was launched once before, so it's a reused booster. It's the second time they've done that. Back in April, they did the first one, but this is the second one. This one was first used, I believe it was January. Remember the launch from Vandenberg Air Force Base? Falcon 9 was launched, and they had all these Iridium satellites, 10 of them, each one weighed like 2,000 pounds, and they put them into orbit all at one time, and when they were up there, they separated one at a time. Well, that booster came back and landed on an autonomous barge out in the Pacific Ocean, and they floated that back, and they carted it all the way back to Texas and tested the engines to make sure they were okay. And now they brought it back to Florida. In fact, a couple of hours after they launched, a cargo vehicle a couple of weeks ago to the space station, they launched the Dragon. Right, a couple of hours later, they were moving this thing back into their facility to get ready to put a second stage on it and test the stage out in Florida before they launched it this Saturday. And the cool thing about this is it's also going to land on an autonomous barge out in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean this time. I'd say the middle, about 400 miles out. And a couple of days later, they'll float that thing back to Cape Canaveral. And go through that with a fine-tooth comb and prepare to launch it again if all goes well for another launch. So SpaceX is doing what they said they were going to do years ago when they first started driving the course down of launching vehicles in space. And the launches will come down even more significantly as this system of reusing boosters and other parts of the space vehicle as well as time goes on. The price will definitely dramatically drop, and things are really going to get interesting, and we're going to get to a point where we'll be able to follow all the launches. As it is now, they're launching SpaceX, like they say, is about once every 2 weeks, sometimes a little over 2 weeks, and that's really picking up the pace. They have two launch complexes that they're working with right now. The one here in Florida, Launch Complex 39A, that they're going to be launching the Bulgarian satellite from, and they still have use of Vandenberg Air Force Base. They've taken over the launch complex over there called 4E, and SpaceX will be launching another Iridium satellite probably within, I guess, a month or so, maybe 2 months from California. So that should be interesting. Let me drop it. SpaceX just got another contract for a launch this August to launch the orbital test vehicle number 5. There's been four of these things that have been launched for the military, for the Air Force. Done four launches so far, starting in 2010. And each one goes up for incremental longer periods of time. The first one went up for like 270 days. Eventually came back, landed in Vandenberg Air Force Base. Another one was built, again, by Boeing. And they had another launch that lasted a lot longer, and they've been doing this ever since. Last one they just came back was up for over 700 days. So it goes up and does all its top secret missions. You know, it's a top secret Air Force mission. Flight OT, a orbital test, ATV, orbital test vehicle. This is the fifth launch. They call it OTV-5. What they do with this is they put it inside, they encapsulate it in a fast for the last four missions. They had a contract with United Launch Alliance to launch on a Atlas V rocket, which they've done successfully for years now. And out here on the fifth launch, they decided to sign up with SpaceX, and now they're going to launch this thing back up in August. Looks like they're dealing with just two vehicles, and one goes up, and then the next one goes up, and so on. So, interesting thing about it is when it comes back, it doesn't land in the water. The first three launches came back and landed on a runway in Vandenberg Air Force Base. Naturally, by the way, this is unmanned, of course. Landed there three times. This mission, this 730-day mission, whatever it was, came back and landed on the same runway that the shuttles used to run, land there. Shuttles on a 3-mile-long runway in Florida. So they came back, and now they'll have to ship it from Florida, from California to Florida to get it ready. This is WS. And there's so many other private contractors or private companies involved. You know, I mentioned probably every week. I'll talk about Virgin Galactic, and I'll talk about Blue Origin and Bigelow. And now this new one started about a year and a half ago, a little less than that, called Axiom Space, AXIOM, Axiom Space, is a company that's planning to build their own space station. And they've already got arrangements with NASA. If they get the first module built to send the first module up in 2020, it's not written in stone yet, but they got agreements to start getting ready to do something like that. The goal is to eventually send about 7 different modules up and attach it to the space station, or partially anyway, maybe 2 or 3 of them, depending how it goes. And the goal is to have a private space station. We're going to use the International Space Station for now and send up a couple of modules, dock to the space station, make them operational. And then at some point, right now it's 2024, the International Space Station will eventually start to come to a grinding halt. Talk about going to 2028. Personally, I think we're going to go to 2028. But whatever that time is, and these big modules are attached to the space station, and then NASA wants to deorbit, their pieces of it. These new modules that go up by Axiom will separate and become their own private space station, eventually able to hold a crew of 7 people on a regular basis. So we'll see how it works out. It's early yet, a year and a half or so in operation. They have a lot of big names, people from NASA that work for NASA that are involved with this now. They left NASA or retired or whatever it is. I understand that they have a lot of contacts and money involved. And we'll see what happens. I think it's a long shot because the numbers I've heard, only a couple of $1 billion are expected to build this thing, to have a crew of 7 people. Where the International Space Station was built is built with $100 billion. So, I'm not sure what it, sure those numbers are going to have to change in the future. to have an Axiom space station. And now where that's going to put Bigelow in the future, I don't know. Bigelow plans on doing a similar thing with inflatable modules, creating his own space station. So it's a possibility you could have eventually two private space stations in orbit around the Earth. Plenty of space vehicles eventually to go to and from. So that should be it's something we're forward to anyway. A lot of foreign companies are starting to do a little bit better. Russia has a rocket called the Proton rocket, and they've had some problems with this thing over the years. It's a heavy lift vehicle, and it's been kind of grounded for a year, so due to a lot of technical problems that I won't go into right now, but they have used quite a few protons in the past, but they've had, you know, one too many failures. So they have just launched last week another proton rocket for the first time in quite a long time, and it was successfully launched. They put up a satellite, actually an American satellite for an American company, to almost a geosynchronous orbit around 30 degrees. That's one foreign country. Another one is India. India has been progressively getting better and better, and they have a rocket called the GSLV, Geostationary Satellite Launch Vehicle, that they've built. That's not, you know, they have another one that's their main workhorse. They've probably launched 30 or 40 times already. PSLV, Polar Satellite Launch Vehicle, but the GSLV is a heavier lift vehicle. So now they're able to launch very heavy payloads to geosynchronous orbit, which they have. You know, they've been able to go to geosynchronous, but not with the heavier payloads that they just did last week. So with all these countries in competition with one another, all these drivers in competition with one another, things are going to get very interesting within a year or two. In fact, they're getting very competitive right now. One topic we talked about last week was the Parker Solar Satellite. We kind of didn't fill in the blanks on some of the questions. One of the questions Dick and I were trying to figure out was the temperatures that this thing will get up to. This is a satellite called the Parker Solar Satellite that will go very close to the sun, closer to the sun than anything that we've sent in the past. We sent the solar investigating satellites up before, but nothing that's going to go this close. This should go less than 4 million miles, around 3.7 million miles to the surface of the sun. Okay, my radio overheated. Put a fan on. So that's what's going to happen with that thing. So the questions that were unanswered was the temperature. 2,500 degrees it could go up to. We found that out. And the speed will be relative to the surface of the sun. At one point, it will be 450,000 miles per hour. That breaks the all-time record by Helios, which was another solar satellite that we launched many, many years ago. We blew that record away, 450,000 miles per hour. That's pretty much it for now. There's plenty of other things on the list, but we'll go back to you. K2RIW, WS2.
One of the questions you had has still not been settled on, Eric. Is that so? The air conditioning system that's on Parker has to dump a hell of a lot of heat to somewhere. What in the world does it use as a heat sink? Because everything in its vicinity is hot, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, it's going to have some kind of cooling system. Some kind of actual refrigeration type cooling system. I haven't, you know, gotten the details yet on that. When it's close to the sun, that's what it's going to be doing. Now, this pulp is going to last till 25, so it's going to do a lot of orbits, I think 20 some odd orbits around the sun, some number like that. Let me drop it. And it's going to take about 7 years to get in there, you know, each time closer and closer, using Venus as gravity assist. We talked about that last week too, gravity assist Venus. It turns out I defined out 7 different passes of Venus. So, there you go. And it's elliptical, so when it's away from the sun to some degree, it'll be using the solar panels in a different fashion. They won't need to be cooling it off. But when it gets it close, they have to cool it off. Back to you, Dick.
So they're going to be 7 passes of Venus to try to make the orbit more and more circular. But even the final orbit is still going to be fairly elliptical. But the perigee, so to speak, I think you said it's 4 million miles. The sun is roughly 450 thousand miles. Let me think now. Yeah, it's 0.9 million miles in diameter. So 4 million miles from the sun. It's something like 5 times the diameter of the sun is the distance that the Parker is going to be from the sun. That's pretty darn close. And that's probably going to be touching the top of the so-called chromosphere, or the... what's the layer of that ionized, invisible layer of material on the upper surface of the sun that's running at some ridiculously high temperature? The corona, I guess. I think the sun's corona runs close to 1 million degrees, Paul, WS2N, K2IW.
Yeah, which is much hotter than the surface of the sun. Going back to old Carl Sagan books, he always believed that all these different, corona mass ejections and all the, you know, everything coming off the sun is smashing into this corona. I mean, you know, and that action of hitting the corona from down below. And with even sound waves is, you know, heating the corona up. Well, they're going to find out with this thing, what I believe they will, when it gets in that close. You know, we're beating the record by, you know, well, the closest we ever got was Helios, and it was 10 times further away, roughly one-third AU, which put it around 30 million miles. This is, let's call it one-tenth the distance. So it's a big, big difference from what we were able to do, and that was a long time ago with those two satellites.
The 39 flybys of Venus, I'm guessing there's roughly half a year in between of those. 7 flybys, I think you said, of Venus. So this whole mission's going to take about 4 or 5 years to finally get into the final configuration where it makes its measurements. And the corona of the sun, I think it's only visible during a total eclipse. And if that corona is running 1 million degrees Fahrenheit, centigrade, almost doesn't matter. My guess is it has a lot of ultraviolet output. So if you take an ultraviolet picture of the sun during a total eclipse, I think that's when you get a pretty clear image of the corona. It's a bunch of guesses on my part. Over you, Paul, K2IW.
Yeah, okay, there's a lot of file film of eclipses. And we'll be able to, I know NASA will have it on live August 21st this year. You know, we're in New York, so I guess we don't see anything. Go down south, you will, and those people will get a chance to see just that. They'll see the corona. It can only last a couple of minutes from their perspective. But must be a lot of people with modern science equipment looking at this like they do every time it comes around. Sometimes it's New Zealand or Australia or someplace, but this time it's in the United States. But that'll be a big news event. Dick, any other comments or questions covering this new Axiom company or SpaceX, Blue Origin? There is some news that happened with this week with Cygnus. Cygnus is attached to the space station. Let me drop it. Cygnus mission, which they name each Cygnus cargo vehicle that goes up after an astronaut or somebody famous that's passed away. This was the John Glenn mission, and it was attached for the last couple of months to the node Unity, facing the Earth. And they weren't going to disconnect until late July, but there's only now three astronauts on board the International Space Station, where a week or two ago you had five, but now you have three. So there's a lot of work up there. And NASA wanted to naturally bring up the next cargo vehicle launched by SpaceX. Like I said at the beginning of the net, and that, they launched the Dragon cargo vehicle. But the day it was supposed to launch, it didn't launch because of lightning strikes. Lightning was very close to the pad, and they scrubbed out the mission. And they waited 2 days. Now they have to wait 2 days because there's perishable cargo that goes on some of these flights. So that had to be removed, stored, and then, reinstalled onto Dragon. Anytime they do that, you can't go to the next day. So they went 2 days later. But because of that slight delay, the astronauts, scheduling, NASA decided, well, instead of waiting another month or so to release Cygnus, we're ready to go now. Let's do it now. So they did it in between that time. So John Glenn Cygnus cargo vehicles that was launched by orbital, paid for by Orbital ATK and launched on a Atlas V rocket launched by United Launch Alliance a couple of months ago from Florida was detached from the space station, and then it flies for a couple of days because it does science all by itself after it leaves the space station, although it's got a bunch of cargo, trash, things that need to be burnt up in the atmosphere. It also has certain experiments on board. It had a couple of CubeSats on board that, after releasing from the space station on its own, this Cygnus cargo vehicle released the CubeSats, and then they also have this is the third, they call it Safe Fire, a test of lighting a fire on board a spacecraft, in this case, unmanned. And they have it in these, one by one meter box, cameras and all kinds of telemetry, different materials. They want to see how different materials react and how do flames work in space, and that type of thing. The fumes is let off. So they had Safe Fire 3. They've done two of these previously. After doing that, it was scheduled to deorbit and burn up over the Pacific, and that was today. So whether or not that happened today or not, I'll have to check the website. Probably, maybe have it tonight or something. As of the beginning of the net, anyway, I could not find out if Cygnus had successfully burnt up in the atmosphere yet or not. So that's the problem that they have on the space station with only three people. You just have one Russian. He would be the commander of the Soyuz craft if they needed to leave. And you still have Peggy Whitson, who's now broken all kinds of records for time and space by an American.
including the most amount of EVAs by any American. Just the most amount of time. So she's still up there with Jack Fisher, who is the same astronaut that we just talked to in here with Mark Hackama on May 22nd. So he's still up there, and just the three of them have to maintain this $100 billion flying space station. Not only do you have to do all the science, they have to maintain the space station. You know, things break, and they have to do unscheduled EVAs like they did last month. Things all come up, and that's why they really need a bigger crew up there. So, at the end of this month, another Russian Soyuz craft will be going up. Correction, I think, I believe it's the end of July, not June. Another spacecraft will be going up sometime in July, and that will bring the crew back to six. The goal is to eventually have a permanent crew of seven, and that's probably coming probably next year, sometime next year, 2018. Back to you, Dick. This is WS2A.
Paul, once the space shuttle was decommissioned, of all the astronauts or cosmonauts that have come down from the International Space Station, has every one of them come down in a Soyuz, or have any of them come down in any of those other space vehicles that are being developed? Over to you, Paul, K2RIW.
Yeah, everybody's coming down in a Soyuz, and they're all going up in a Soyuz, and it's been going on. Well, it's been going on since the beginning. Even when the shuttle was going up on, up there on a regular basis, she still had Soyuz flights going up and down. So that's just continued. None of the other vehicles are human rated yet by NASA. The closest one will be the Dragon. Right now it's a cargo vehicle. They're building a version of Dragon that's going to be a crewed vehicle, which will probably fly a test flight, I think, in November of this month. It'll be an unmanned flight, dock to the space station, come back, and then you'll have a crew, one NASA astronaut and one SpaceX astronaut that will be going up to the space station in probably the spring, maybe late spring of next year. And then after doing a couple of those flights, then NASA will say, okay, you do regular operations, which will, in the long run, will bring up four at a time. So four at a time, four up, four down. And that won't be the only one. You'll have Boeing doing the same thing. They're building the Starliner, which will be able to bring up four and bring down four. So that's why you needed all these astronauts. Last week, Vice President Pence went to Houston to welcome the 12 new astronauts. We talked about how many there were going to be. I said it could have been anywhere between 8 and 20. Nobody knew. Let me drop it. No, it worked out. Average wound up at 12. So you have all these new astronauts, two from Pennsylvania, one from Texas, one from the state of Washington, a couple of other places, including one from Baldwin, Long Island. So that's pretty good. She called Baldwin, Long Island her home. Jasmine, I forgot her last name, I'll have to look it up. Jasmine is from Long Island. And these people will be ready to fly sometime in the future. And they'll be, among other things, going to the space station. Maybe now to the new Axiom space station. Maybe to the Bigelow space station. Or maybe to the Deep Space Gateway. This is the DSG being built, Deep Space Gateway. That's being planned to go to the moon, orbit the moon, and eventually, in the beginning, you'll have, after it's put together somewhat, you'll have a crew of four that could spend 40 or more days there. and ultimately spend up to a year there, that will be, you know, that you're going to need astronauts to go to all these places. So that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised if there was another class that gets brought in a couple of years from now, drop it. The last class was 2013, and that brought in 8 astronauts, 4 men, 4 women. That was the first time, it was 50-50. And there you go, between us and the Russians, India, maybe eventually in 2030 or so, they should have a manned space program, and China, and, you know, could get to the point where you won't be able to keep track of who's up there. Back to you, Dick. WS2N.
All of the 12 new astronauts, how many of them are women? And of this planned future mission where you're going to put astronauts around the moon for as long as 40 days, what does a man in orbit around the moon do that cannot be done with a unmanned vehicle? Because I'm sure you're not going to put any men on the moon for more than a couple of days because of the temperature problem. Oh, you both, C2IW.
Well, the idea of the deep space gateway is to practice. I mean, they would want to practice living in space autonomously without any supplies to any degree. They want to test the deep space habitat network, which will eventually be able to go to Mars. They've got to be able to test all this stuff. They want to be able to do it not in Earth orbit, in lunar orbit, for a number of reasons. They, you know, now, while they're there, they want to operate robotic equipment on the moon. They'll be able to do that. They're close to it. They won't need to worry about time. This time, 1.5 seconds delay that you have from here to Earth, or maybe a little over 2 seconds. Earth to the moon, you know, they'll be right there, so they'll be able to operate equipment in real time from orbit. But outside of doing that, they'll really be testing to spend a lot of time seeing how they can do things autonomously without resupplying anything from Earth. Drop it. Outside of that, we'll have to wait and see. Oh, by the way, there's 5 women out of the group of 12 this time. Dick?
Okay, 5 women, so 7 men. Now, there have been habitat experiments on the Earth that tried to be self-sustaining. And with all the great resources of Earth, I don't think they've really succeeded. So to do that in space without renewable supplies being brought up, that strikes me as a future dream, but I don't think we're there yet, Paul. I don't think they're able to recycle everything. Am I wrong on that one, K2IW?
Not everything, but they're working on it. You know, oxygen, I think, is like 97% or something is recycled. Water is 97%. It's just whatever percent it is. I know oxygen is way up there, 97%. So, they're getting there, right? You know, it's not enough yet. And the main thing, of course, is going to be food and all of that. In fact, one of the people that was chosen, I forget if it's a guy or a girl, they've gone to these different things that they have on Earth. I don't know if it was the one in Utah or the one in Hawaii. NASA does these deals where people can live in these habitats. Simulate living on Mars. It's not an exact analogy, but it's close enough for their studies. They study different things. Psychology is one of them. Another person has spent a lot of time on submarines. Another one a lot of time down in Antarctica. So, you know, they have all these people that could handle these long, lonely places. connected to quite a few of those people. Among the pilots, test pilots.